Friends, last Monday I joined the people who live on the M2 Monday through Friday. Thought I would just see what that was like for grins. I know enough about this world to know that if you're not on the M2 before 10 to 6 in the morning, then life is lost. You spend 2 hours in that car park. And so I was on the M2 before 10 to 6, which is great. Got me to Town Hall before 7 a.m. For a meeting that was beginning at 9:30 a.m. I knew that that would be the case, so I thought it's better to sit in the city and eat McDonald's than sit on the M2 and eat carbon monoxide, in my humble opinion. So I went to McDonald's, did my devotions, used REAP, read the Bible, and then when I finished that, went back to the car, put stuff in the car, ready for the meeting. I thought it would be an easy thing to do, to go from where I'd parked the car through Town Hall Station to the train, but I was in for another lesson. I turned out of the St Andrews Arcade, if you know this at all, it's under the Town Hall Station in St Andrews. I turned a particular corner, and first, as I was turning the corner, a guy just ran into it, just walked straight in me as if I wasn't there. I thought, they're off to a good start. And then, as I turned the corner, I looked up, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people coming at breakneck speed from the train in my direction. I looked around and thought, I'm the only one going in that direction. And hundreds were coming in this direction. Everyone at this human peak hour looked like they'd not had coffee. Stern-faced, focused, zombie-like. The tsunami of people were rushing at breakneck speed away from Train Hall Station, and their faces just said to me quietly and sternly, "Pity help the man who is not with us." Those city commuters are battle-hardened of years of moving in step with one another through the arcade. There were young women wearing power suits but not Prada on their feet. They were wearing Nike. Nike was quite interesting because Nike is the Greek word for the goddess of victory, Nike. And so these young women were out for victory. It was clear that they were not going to let some mere male, that would be me, stand between them and their office. And so they just kept coming. There were ladies with handbags that swung in time with their gait. And as they did that, they hit certain parts of male bodies that wasn't all that pleasant. Briefcases and umbrellas and newspapers were swung like weapons in the hands of these commuter commandos. The most dangerous of all, I have to say, I am ashamed to say, the most dangerous of all are men with MP3 players. The earbuds are going, the white cord, the thing, and they're watching the screen. Men really cannot do two things at once. They cannot walk and observe and listen to music. And so I got ran over I don't know how many times. The only time I felt like this before in my life, as I reflected on it, was when I played for Warners Bay High School in the state rugby league competition called the Waratah Shield. We were playing Scone High School. The country boys are big. I was in year 8 or 9 at the time. I was playing a halfback in an open competition. The country back line were huge. The forwards were huger. And I thought to myself, but I have a train to catch. And so I began using moves and steps that I'd not used since those days of rugby league in high school. I got off to a good start, but I noticed that my mind was seeing what it wanted to do. But my body was sort of dragging the chain a little bit. My sidestep and swerve had changed. My fleet of footstep became a 2 left foot trip hazard. Town Hall Arcade is a few hundred metres long, but 30 metres into this, words of my old minister came back. When we were at the old church down here, John Alexander Brooke was preaching. And if you remember John, he would stand in the pulpit motionless like this, have his glasses like this, and he would preach over his glasses. And I remember him saying, don't know how he got to the point, but he said one day, of course, it's only dead fish that swim downstream. And that thought crossed my mind as the whole stream of humanity was coming at me at that particular point in time. I understood why dead fish swim downstream, because to go against the stream is to take your life into your own hands. And saying no to yet another after-work conference foray into a nightclub scene leaves you alone and sometimes can leave you drained because you've broken away from the crowd one more time. Being consistent and persistent in the raising of children, instilling good manners and habits in them, modeling sane lifestyles to them, reminding boys to put the toilet seat down after 20-odd years, it takes the toll, doesn't it? And after a while, dead fish swimming downstream look attractive. They're not under stress. In fact, if you look at their little faces, you see that there's a little smile across their face because they are not under stress. But as attractive as it might be to be a dead fish, it's not much of a solution, is it? All it does is absorb you into the faceless crowd while strangling passion out of you and pouring cold water on dreams that you have to leave a legacy. To go with the crowd can be draining, it can be turbulent, but if you go with the crowd, it's lifeless. The solution is not found in being a dead fish. The solution comes from a first century document written to a church facing their own town hall tsunami. This is the letter written to a people we know simply as the Hebrews. These people were the Christians in Rome facing the onslaught of Nero. His persecutions meant the crowds kept calling out to them, "Give up on Christ, run with us, that way you will live. Give up on Jesus," they said. We're in a series called Run. And you may recall that the writer of the Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, since we are surrounded by the heroes of the faith, we are on the racetrack. Since we are on the racetrack, let us run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us. Strip off everything that hinders. Strip off everything that hinders, because you are in a race and you are running against the crowd." And he says to us this week, keep your eyes on the pace setter. We've seen over the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've seen legends of the track. And now the writer to the Hebrews says, I want you to look at the pace setter and run close to him, run on his shoulder. Then you will know how to continue to run against the crowd. So let's hear what the Bible has to say, Hebrews chapter 11 and then verse 12. Hebrews 11, then chapter 12.
Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, and you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who have disciplined us and respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it.
Now, friends, to us who live in a world that is wearied and we are wearied, this sounds like insanity. We feel like we want to sit down, slow down, sit in a corner and do anything but run. But the writer holds his ground here in this ancient document and he says, you run close to the pace setter. It makes all the difference in the world if you run close to him. And you want to do this because in the first couple of verses it says, Jesus is the author and the perfecter of our faith. He wrote the book on how to live. He knows how to run when the crowd wants you to run in a different pace. He is the pace setter. And so, it says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Fix your eyes on him. Consider him in verse 3. Study him. Stay close to him. Pace yourself off him so you will know how to run and how to live, he says. And the writer says there are three lessons and two observations to be made by looking at Jesus. The first lesson is this: build endurance. Build endurance so that we become like Jesus, who was known for his endurance. Jesus' endurance didn't simply come from years of negotiating peak hour human traffic in Town Hall Station. He endured opposition from sinful men. If you've been reading the Bible with me, following the REAP that Keith highlighted earlier, we're going through Mark's Gospel at the moment. At the beginning of Mark, everybody is for Jesus. But partway through chapter 3, the tide starts to turn against Jesus. The religious black belts start trying to work out how to kill Jesus. They're constantly niggling away at him in public. They hire Judas to set Jesus up. They get Jesus into a kangaroo court. They bring up false charges. They beat him. They hand him over to Pilate for crucifixion. Jesus then endures crucifixion with all of its pain and all of its shame. And it was an enduring thing. Crucifixion was a horrendous experience. You see, at the hands of the executioners, crucifixion was an opportunity for capricious soldiers to give full expression to their sadism. There were no lobby groups to protect the innocent or the victims and say it's all inhumane. If anyone stood up and did this, the soldiers would just grab them and start beating them. And Jesus endured the shame associated with crucifixion, which rivaled the pain. Jesus was stripped naked, for example, for all the world to see. Now, that I don't know how that rings in your ears, but we live in a world which is made infamous by Facebook and Twitter, where nude photos are sent by people as a lark and a laugh to send around to their friends. It's all fine until parents discover the photo, or a child discovers the photo, or a potential employer does his or her research and discovers the photo. Then it's not so much fun. To be stripped naked for public ridicule brings deep shame, particularly when your hands are restricted from modesty because they're kind of nailed out. There was no little modesty cloth given to Jesus at his crucifixion, like statues of the crucified Jesus or paintings are wanting to do. Jesus experienced the shame of crucifixion. The creator of the universe, the Son of God, the one worshipped by angels since before creation, the one who will be worshipped by his people forever, endured crucifixion and scorned its shame. He did not let weariness or despair or discouragement deter him. He endured it all. He set the pace on how to live when the crowd is coming at you. The question is, how did he do that? I mean, how could you do that? Well, in part, his endurance was built up over time. If you're reading through Mark's Gospel with us, you would have seen that everyone's for him at the beginning and then there's little niggles and the niggles get more intense and more intense until he's beaten to within each of his life and then he endures the crucifixion. So he built it up over the course of a lifetime. But according to Hebrews, a larger and more significant reason why Jesus could endure this was because of his view of the future. You see it there in verse 12:2, it says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. Who for the joy. This is the second lesson. Look beyond the finish line. Look beyond the finish line. There will come a day when Jesus will be beside himself with joy. There will be a day. It's the kind of joy that he will experience. The kind of joy he will experience is like what we get when we get our internet order. It turns up, you know, you've done your research, you've done your planning, you've got yourself a really good deal, you've set the order, you've paid for it by PayPal. The package is coming. You can track it coming, and it's going to get to your door in a day, in a few hours, and it turns up, and you have the package in your hand. Your joy exceeds anything else at that particular moment, and you open it up. It's your joy. Though Jesus' joy will be much better than that internet bargain that you've picked up. His joy is kind of like the joy that a woman is looking forward to in the midst of childbirth. While that joy keeps her going, Jesus' joy is greater. You see, according to passages like Zephaniah 3:17, Jesus is going to do a merry dance and sing over us with joy when we all gather around him on the last day. According to Ephesians chapter 1, another ancient document from the New Testament, a number of times in the first half a dozen verses, God tells us, for his pleasure does he redeem us. For his pleasure does he send Jesus to draw us home to himself. It's all according to his great pleasure. Jesus endured the cross and scorned its shame because there will come a day when he will be beside himself with joy because he gets to gather all of his people and celebrate with them forever, forever. That's why he endured opposition from sinful men and the crucifixion and the shame. That's why he set his face with such determination that nothing would deter him, because we are so precious to him. We need to look beyond the finish line of raising children and retirement and even our last breath. We need to look and see what Jesus saw. There will come a day when he will sit us down and he will wipe away all of our tears, according to Revelation 21. He'll wipe away all of our pain and all of our tears. And we need to see that really clearly, because that means there will come a day when we will have our tears wiped away. When he will take away all of our pain and all of our mourning and all of our crying, we will be the recipients of the tender hands of Jesus before the huge celebration begins. We need to keep this in mind. There will come a day when everyone will see that swimming upstream was worth the effort. There will come a day when the bullies of this world will be, who have trampled on the vulnerable, whether they are in office blocks, shop floors, or in Central Africa, like that guy Kony. Did you see that thing during the week on Kony? Unbelievable. For a quarter of a century, this man has been brutalizing children and women for no reason. That man will be brought to justice one day. That man and everyone else like him will be brought to justice by Jesus. The more clearly we see this, the more the weariness of swimming upstream will lift. It's kind of like when you get a holiday organized, isn't it? You know what that's like. You think, I need a holiday. And so you sit down and you start to plan it. You start to look at brochures. You start to think about where you go. And the weariness starts to lift a little. But when you book the holiday, you settle on dates, you've booked a place to stay, you've booked transport, or however you're going to do it, when you've done the booking and you send enter, you press enter and the whole thing's done and paid for, you may still have 4 weeks to go to holidays, but you breathe a little easier, don't you? Because there is an end coming that is a whole lot better than today. We need to keep our eyes beyond the finish line, because there is coming a day when we will join Jesus in his joy. The third lesson is this: strip down for the run ahead. Strip down. You see what it says in verse 3 or verse 1? Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything. Throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and then let us run. Strip down whatever gets in the road of you running on the shoulder of Jesus. Strip it down. strip off the poor eyesight, which sees the rewards offered by the corporations we work for, or the business we work in, or the shares that we make. Strip off the poor eyesight that sees those rewards as brilliant and the end and be all. Strip that eyesight off, because God offers more. He offers much, much more. The love of money, because strip off the love of money, because the love of money does significant damage to a human soul. Strip it away, particularly when you see beyond the finish line and see that it what we think now is worth is has a lot of worth will be worthless at the end of time. We think gold is the mark of wealth. We think we should pursue that. Our society pursues that. In heaven, it will be about as worthless as bitumen, because all the streets of heaven will be paved with gold. Strip off poor eyesight. Strip off the love of money. Strip off the anxiety for a greater status, particularly when you see that in the end, no matter what level you rise to, it doesn't matter. If you're not sure about that and you've got some time to kill, go to a cemetery and look at the headstones. I do this sometimes at funerals. It's part of my job. The other day I was doing a wedding and the graveyard came right up to the front door of the church, which sort of made that attractive. But I thought I'd have a wander around, and those headstones have been there a long time. Some of the headstones, I can't tell you when the person was buried, because all the letters have been etched away by the wind and the rain. So I can't tell you what level this person rose to. I can't tell you how much wealth they had. I can't tell you anything about them, because there's nothing to see on the headstone. And that headstone could not be more than 150 years old. Strip off things that get in our road. Strip away the clutter from your diary. Like one woman I heard of during the week was in the house of her pastor for one reason or another. And one piece of conversation led to another, and she ended up talking to her pastor and ended up in tears. Pastors have that effect sometimes. And the reason why she was in tears is because she was weary. Three children, each doing four things over and above school each week. Now, she was trying to work out why her world was falling apart. And a minister said to her, "You're dumb. That is dumb. Because what you're doing is living in a car." And you know when you're living in the land of the car, don't you? You know it's dumb when you start doing the math. Take the number of extracurricular activities that you can squeeze into a seven-day period for each child, as if they were your only child, and then multiply that by the number of children that you have. Divide that by the time it takes you to negotiate Showground Road and the M2. Add to that the number of McDonald's brown paper bags and chips and fries that are on your floor, and that will lead to a loose-lipped raspberry, won't it? If you live in the land of the car way beyond dumb, you do this loose-lipped raspberry at the beginning of the day, without even thinking about the day ahead and all the stuff that you have to do with all this extracurricular activity. Strip out your diary. Each of these things makes it difficult to see beyond the finish line, let alone to run close to Jesus. Now, some of you are sitting there going, John, time out, time out. You're asking the impossible. This is just too hard. The Hebrew writer hears you and makes two observations. One's negative, one's positive. Hang through the negative so we can get to the positive. The negative one is this. Observation number one, you haven't bled yet. That's more or less how he says it. You haven't bled yet. Look at verse 4. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Now, friends, we're in stadium. I want you to imagine we are in the stadium. We're on the stadium track. Around us are the great ones sitting in their seats, and they're cheering us on to run. In the stadium in the first century, it simply wasn't an athletic stadium. It was a gladiatorial stadium. That meant in the practice of the games, as the games started there was always a gladiatorial combat and there was always blood spilled. Always. And so the athletes would run in a stadium stained with blood. And the writer says, you haven't resisted to the point of shedding blood yet. And like the first century readers, we are still breathing while others have had blood liberated from their bodies because they followed Jesus. You remember their nameless ones from Hebrews 11? Some were sawn in two. Others were put to death by the sword. In our time, there was the whole Ugandan church in the 1970s, ruthlessly, mercilessly murdered by Idi Amin. In the 1980s through to the year 2000, there were the Sudanese and the Vietnamese who were ruthlessly put to death. In our day, Nigerians, Egyptians, Australian missionaries. Right now in Syria, a man that we would call a brother is going to be killed because he names the name of Jesus. And the writer says, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. What is more startling is that Jesus shed his blood and his body is eternally scarred. We'll know Jesus in heaven because the nail marks in his hands and his feet and the spear in his side will still be there for us to see. The Bible says it may be hard. Yep, it may be hard. And it is hard. Who has not wanted to give up following Jesus at one point or another? I could count the number of times in the thousands that I have wanted to, because it just gets too hard. But the writer says the martyrs and Jesus spilled their blood in the stadium when they ran. So the question is, will you remain faithful with a lesser amount of suffering? Now, we want to press pause, I know, because this is so negative. It's not politically correct. We are told never to use shame in communication, and yet the author is using shame. But we understand shame from one degree to another, don't we? We don't like being caught out or being caught short, and we experience shame. Our face goes red and our heart beats. We hate it when we experience shame. The writer has said, I know you hate it. But I want you to avoid the shame at the end of the race. We are not beaten. We're not killed for standing up for Jesus or standing up in his name to defend the poor or the widow, the orphan or the migrant. We just merely grow weary and we lose heart. And the writer says, keep going. Keep going. You haven't shed blood yet. Keep going. Now, my journey over the last 30-odd years has been something like this. In my early days, I sensed Jesus putting his arm around and say, there, it's okay, you know, we'll strengthen you up, you'll be fine, we'll take some steps. And that went on for a period of years. And then I sensed him saying, hey, Jeremiah 12:5 says, if you can't run with men, how are you going to run with horses where I want you to run? If you can't run on level ground, how are you going to run in the scrub and the mountains where I want you to run? Harden up a little, will you? And then lately, for the last couple of years, Hebrews 10:38 has been ringing in my ears. My righteous one will live by faith, and if he should shrink back, this is Jesus speaking, I will not be pleased with him. It's kind of my teaspoon of cement verse. You know, take a teaspoon of cement and harden up. There is a race to run. You've not shed blood yet. Suck it up, princess, and move. Now, that's my journey. If you need to hear that, then join me. We'll weep together afterwards. Observation two, God is actually treating you like his child. Pain and difficulty associated with following Jesus is evidence that you are his much-loved child. Jesus learned obedience in his suffering. Jesus was made perfect in his suffering, the writer of the Hebrews says. He developed and matured as God's son in the midst of suffering, and so it will be no less for us. And so the writer goes on and says, you have forgotten the word that was preached to you, that you are much God's much loved son. No matter what we face or from whom, God takes it and uses it to train us. Is it painful? Well, yes, of course it's painful. But it leads to maturity, the Bible says here in verse 11. It leads to maturity. God has this ability to take an expression of hostility expressed towards us and turn that into a means to make us like him. What is crucial is the set of our heart. If we see unpleasantness or pain or adversity as an imposition, if we see pain or adversity as an affront to our thinking that we are entitled, if we see pain and adversity as an opposition to our belief that God owes us, then we will not mature. We'll be unweaned children, a toddler in an adult's body. But if we accept these things as discipline at the hands of our Father, something in his hands designed to make us like him, then we become like one who has weaned our soul before God. And a weaned soul before God is fertile soil for righteousness and peace to grow. We become more like Jesus at that point. The last couple of times I've preached, I've talked to you about someone who comes to this church, a different service, who's experiencing extraordinary illness at the moment, very rare forms of cancer. Nearly died twice. And his emails are often, praise God because I've had this opportunity and God has been kind, and so it goes on. Last week, his company terminated his job. Know what his response is? Oh, it hurts and I've got questions. But God has closed one door and he's now opening another. I don't know where it will lead yet, but it will come. When we run like this, we declare to the whole world, Jesus is God. Jesus is the only one who can restore marriages and provide refuge for healing. He is the one who can free us from our past when our past wants to condemn us. Jesus is the hope of the world that is struggling with the realities of the world's number one wanted man, Kony, in Central Africa. Jesus is the only one who can help a fretting soul and a fearful heart and plant hope in a deep in a human heart so that we can live one more time. If we give up running, what will that say to the world about our God or what we think about him? It will say he's not worth the effort. But if we run because we've discovered that God does bring hope, he does apply forgiveness, he is a safe harbor. If we run because we know at the end of time he will wipe away our tears and there will be a celebration. We run because the pace setter has set the standard and the encouragement rings out from the stands on his lips. He yells out, run. No matter what the pain, no matter the hardship, keep running. Stay on my shoulder. Keep running. So strip away everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles and run with perseverance. Fix your eyes on the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorned its shame, and then sat down at the right hand of the Father in heaven.